孩子。Thank you. Thank you very much. I was so excited by the possibilities offered by this day that I forgot to shave. This indeed is a landmark occasion, and you do me great honor in inviting me to participate. I am, I publicly confess, an actor and a writer. However, I find that that isn't all I am, and sometimes I'm embarrassed even when the generosity behind the introduction is so apparent as it was tonight. I listen once again to the roll call of the films and the television shows that I've been in, and I blush. I said to Ruby, you know, that's really not me, and maybe we shouldn't send out the bios with those lists. Why don't we instead send out the dossiers that the FBI has on our behavior? Surely they would have something to talk about then. The speeches, the marches, the demonstrations. The appearances before committees, you know, the sudden escapes and all those wonderful things. So I took the trouble to acquire from the FBI my document, the dossier. It was heavy, you know, like a phone book. And I looked and I read. It was the dullest. It had none of my great accomplishments. The FBI had spent time and money getting details about the fact that I appeared somewhere and I spoke or I bought this newspaper or I said that. And when it got to one point, it really did make me feel bad. It accused me of being a fellow traveler to Ruby Dee. I mean, that's my wife. I'm supposed to follow her. So I threw that away too. And I stand before you exposed as a man who, in spite of what it says either on the bio or the dossier, I'm still a lover of the human adventure. Freedom is still the most exciting thing I know. And when we get a chance to say something meaningful about those heroes and heroines who've shown us the way so beautifully, I always leap for the chance to join in. Yet I notice in the bio, for example, it doesn't say that at one time I worked in a film called John Brown's Raid, and the film was made at Harper's Ferry, and I played the part of one of John Brown's men. I was Dangerfield Newby. Yes. So at least that should have been in the bio, you know. And there are other things that I might claim to have accomplished more true. Well, let me tell you, for example, that one of the most important things in my life when I was a student down in Waycross, Georgia, was that every year in February we would have what we call Negro History Week. And we students were required to spend 51 weeks of every year preparing for Negro History Week. And part of my job was to memorize some of these magnificent words of Black people who had accomplished things. And certainly the words of Frederick Douglass were some of the first that struck across my mind and my imagination. And I have tried to be influenced by that man, by his thoughts, by his words, and by the way he expressed himself, and it has led me here directly tonight. This has been so far a wonderful occasion. I think John Brown and Frederick Douglass both would smile to see us here and join in these festivities, because the truth is, John Brown still lives. Now, the FBI, not knowing who John Brown is, but still having some interest in my behavior, will possibly report this incident back to the, and say, hey, we got another one out there called John Brown. I don't know who to, let's assign somebody to check him out. So if they come knocking on your door, you know, they're trying to find it. You just tell them John Brown lives and slam the door in their face. Frederick Douglass, who was a friend of John Brown, had a way with words equaled by few. We've had some great poets in our country and been fortunate to have been blessed by them. Thomas Jefferson and his magnificent words, Abraham Lincoln and his magnificent words, and Frederick Douglass and his magnificent words. And some of those words we would like to share with you tonight. John Brown and his friend joined together in the magnificent struggle, and John leaving and his friend being left behind and having occasion some later years to express the meaning of John Brown to himself and to the rest of the world, a speech he made in 1881. And this is a part of that speech. Not to fan the flame of sectional animosity, now happily in the process of rapid and, I hope, permanent extinction. Not to revive and keep alive a sense of shame and remorse for a great national crime, which has brought its own punishment and loss of treasure, tears, and blood. Not to recount the long list of wrongs inflicted on my race during more than 200 years of merciless bondage, nor yet to draw from the labyrinths of far-off centuries incidents and achievements wherewith to rouse your passions and enkindle your enthusiasm, but to pay a just debt long due, to vindicate in some degree a great historical character of our own time and country, one with whom I was myself well acquainted and whose friendship and confidence it was my good fortune to share, and to give you such recollections, impressions, and facts as I can of a grand, brave, and good old man, and especially to promote a better understanding of the raid upon Harper's Ferry, of which he was the chief, is the object of this address. On the night of the 16th of October, 1859, there appeared near the confluence of the Potomac and Shenandoah Rivers a party of 19 men, 14 white and 5 colored. They were not only armed themselves, but had brought with them a large supply of arms for such persons as might join them. These men invaded Harper's Ferry, disarmed the watchmen, took possession of the arsenal, rifle factory, armory, and other government property at that place, arrested and made prisoners nearly all the prominent citizens of the neighborhood, collected about 50 slaves, put bayonets into the hands of such as were able and willing to fight for their liberty, killed 3 men, proclaimed general emancipation, held the ground more than 30 hours, and were subsequently overpowered and nearly all killed, wounded, or captured by a body of United States troops under the command of Colonel Robert E. Lee, since famous as the Rebel General Lee. 3 out of the 19 invaders were captured while fighting, and one of these was Captain John Brown, the man who originated, planned, and commanded the expedition. At the time of his capture, Captain Brown was supposed to be mortally wounded, as he had severe ugly gashes and bayonet wounds on his head and body. And apprehending that he might speedily die, or that he might be rescued by his friends, and thus the opportunity of making him a signal example of slaveholding vengeance would be lost, his captors hurried him to Charlestown, 2 miles further within the border of Virginia, placed him in prison strongly guarded by troops, and before his wounds were healed, he was brought into court, subjected to a nominal trial, convicted of high treason and inciting slaves to insurrection, and was executed. His corpse was given to his woe-stricken widow, and she, assisted by anti-slavery friends, caused it to be borne to North Elba, Essex County, New York, and there his dust now reposes amid the silent, solemn, and snowy grandeur of the Adirondacks. Viewed apart and alone as a transaction separate and distinct from its antecedents and bearings, the raid takes rank with the most cold-blooded and atrocious wrongs ever perpetrated. But just here is the trouble. This raid on Harper's Ferry, no more than Sherman's March to the Sea, can consent to be viewed alone. To the broad vision of a true philosophy, nothing in this world stands alone. Everything is a necessary part of everything else. Every seed bears fruit after its kind, and nothing is reaped which is not sowed. The distance between seed time and harvest in the moral world may not be quite so well defined or as clearly intelligible as in the physical, yet the harvest nevertheless will surely come. And as in the physical world there are century plants, so it may be in the moral world, and their fruitage is as certain in the one as in the other. The bloody harvest of Harper's Ferry was ripened by the heat and moisture of merciless bondage of more than 200 years. That startling cry of alarm on the bank of the Potomac was but the answering back of the avenging angel to the midnight invasions of Christian slave traders on the sleeping hamlets of Africa. Viewed thus broadly, our subject is worthy of thoughtful and dispassionate consideration. It invites the study of the poet, scholar, philosopher, and statesman. But I can invite you to no such profound discussions. I am not the man, nor is this the occasion for such philosophical inquiry. Mine is the word of grateful memory to an old friend, to tell you what I knew of him, what I knew of his inner life, of what he did and what he attempted, and thus, if possible, to make the mainspring of his actions manifest and thereby give you a clearer view of his character and services. It is said that next in value to the performance of great deeds ourselves is the capacity to appreciate such when performed by others. To more than this, I do not presume. Allow me one other personal word before I proceed. In the minds of some of the American people, I was myself credited with an important agency in the John Brown raid. Governor Henry A. Wise was manifestly of that opinion. He was at pains to have Mr. Buchanan send his marshals to Rochester to invite me to accompany them to Virginia. Fortunately, I left town several hours previous to their arrival. Much has been said of John Brown, much that is wise and beautiful. But in looking over what may be called John Brown literature, I have been little assisted with material and even less encouraged in any hope of access and success in treating the subject. However, despite the hold which slavery had in time on the country, despite the popular prejudice against the Negro, despite the shock which the first alarm occasioned, almost from the first, John Brown received a large measure of sympathy and appreciation. New England recognized in him the spirit which brought the Pilgrim to Plymouth and hailed him as a martyr and a saint. True, he had broken the law. True, he had struck for a despised people. True, he had crept upon his foe stealthily like a wolf upon the fold, and had dealt his blow in the dark while his enemy slept. But with all this and more to disturb the moral sense, men discerned in him the greatest and best qualities known to human nature and pronounced him good. Many consented to his death, then went home and taught their children to sing his praise as one whose soul is marching on through the realms of endless bliss. One element in explanation of this somewhat anomalous circumstance will probably be found in the troubled times which immediately succeeded. For when judgments are abroad in the world, men learn righteousness. The country had before this learned the value of Brown's heroic character. He had shown boundless courage and skill in dealing with the enemies of liberty in Kansas. With men so few and means so small, and odds against them so great, no captain ever surpassed him in achievement, some of which seem almost beyond belief. With only 8 men in that bitter war, he met, fought, and captured Henry Clay Pate with 25 well-armed and mounted men. In this memorable encounter, he selected his ground so wisely, handled his men so skillfully, and attacked the enemy so vigorously that they could neither run nor fight, and were therefore compelled to surrender to a force less than one-third their own. With just 30 men, on another important occasion, during the same border war, he met and vanquished 400 Missourians under the command of General Reed. These men had come into the territory under an oath never to return to their homes till they had stamped out the last vestige of free state spirit in Kansas. But a brush with old Brown took their high conceit out of them, and they were glad to get off upon any terms without stopping to stipulate. With less than 100 men to defend the town of Lawrence, he ordered Offa to lead them and give battle to 1,400 men on the banks of the Waukerusia River, and was much vexed when his office was refused by General Jim Lane and others to whom the defense of the town was confided. Before leaving Kansas, he went into the border of Mississippi, of Missouri, and liberated a dozen slaves on a single night. And in spite of slave laws and marshals, he brought these people through half a dozen states and landed them safely in Canada. With 18 men, this man shook the whole social fabric of Virginia. With 18 men, he overpowered a town of nearly 3,000 souls. With these 18 men, he held that large community firmly in his grasp for 30 long hours. With these 18 men, he rallied in a single night 50 slaves to his standard and made prisoners of an equal number of the slave-holding class. With these 18 men, he defied the power and bravery of a dozen of the best militia companies that Virginia could send against him. Now, when slavery struck, as it certainly did strike, at the life of the country, it was not the fault of John Brown that our rulers did not at first know how to deal with it. He had already shown us the weak side of the rebellion, had shown us where to strike and how. It was not from lack of native courage that Virginia submitted for 30 long hours and at last was relieved only by federal troops, but because the attack was made on the side of her conscience and thus armed her against herself. When John Brown proclaimed emancipation to the slaves of Maryland and Virginia, he added to his war power the force of a moral earthquake. Virginia felt all her strong rib mountains to shake under the heavy tread of armed insurgents. Of his army of 19, her conscience made an army of 1,900. Another feature of the times worthy of notice was the effect of this blow upon the country at large. At the first moment, we were stunned and bewildered. Slavery had so benumbed the moral nation, sense of the nation, that it never suspected the possibility of an explosion like this. And it was difficult for Captain Brown to get himself taken for what he really was. Few could seem to comprehend that freedom to the slaves was his only object. If you will go back with me to that time, you will find that the most curious and contradictory versions of the affair were industriously circulated, and those which were the best, least rational and true seemed to command the readiest belief. In the view of some, it was assumed, it had assumed a tremendous proportion. To such, it was nothing less than a wide sweeping rebellion to overthrow the existing government and construct another upon its ruins, with Brown for its president and commander in chief. The proof of this was found in the old man's carpet bag in the shape of a constitution for a new republic, an instrument which, in reality, had been executed to govern the conduct of his men in the mountains. Smaller and meaner natures saw in it nothing higher than a purpose to plunder. To them, John Brown and his men were a gang of desperate robbers who had learned by some means that government had sent a large sum of money to Harper's Ferry to pay off the workmen in its employ there, and they had gone thence to fill their pockets with this money. The fact is that outside of a few friends scattered in different parts of the country and the slaveholders of Virginia, few persons understood the significance of the hour. that a man might do something very audacious and desperate for money, power, or fame was, to the general apprehension, quite possible. But in face of plainly written law, in face of constitutional guarantees protecting each state against domestic violence, in face of a nation of 40 million people, that 19 men could invade a great state to liberate a despised and hated race was to the average intellect and conscience too monstrous for belief. In this respect, the vision of Virginia was clearer than that of the nation. Conscious of her guilt, and therefore full of suspicion, sleeping on pistols for pillows, startled at every unusual sound, constantly fearing and expecting a repetition of the Nat Turner insurrection, she at once understood the meaning, if not the magnitude, of the affair. It was this understanding which caused her to raise the hasty and imploring cry to the federal government for help. And it was not till he who struck the blow had fully explained his motives and objects that the incredulous nation in any wise comprehended the true spirit of the raid or of its commander.